Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In a surprise about-face from Washington this week, the Bush administration says it now needs the help of the United Nations to secure and to rebuild Iraq. It was only 1 year ago when President Bush challenged the UN to go into Iraq in a robust search for weapons.
All the world now faces a test, and the United Nations a difficult and defining moment. Our Security Council resolutions to be honored and enforced or cast aside without consequence. Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant?
President Bush never publicly accused the UN of being irrelevant, but 6 months later he bypassed its objections and sent the U.S. military into war in Iraq. Now, as the Secretary of State Colin Powell is explaining, it's time to set aside those old disagreements.
There were many of our friends in the Security Council who would have preferred that we not go in, preferred that inspectors continue their work for an indefinite period of time and we don't need to refight that battle. But once we went in, did the job, we then made a conscious decision among the international community that now is the time to mend ranks and to join together in reconstructing Iraq, making it a better place, and not to fight the old battles.
Connection listeners, can the insults and the ill will of the old battles be set aside? Will the world gather under a UN banner for the good of Iraq? And if so, will there be a price for the U.S. to pay? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, during this hour, we will be talking with scholars and diplomats representing different nations at the UN. Joining me in the studio now, Robert Orr. He is Executive Director for Research at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Robert, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you very much.
You've also been a deputy ambassador at the UN, so talk to me a little bit about the timing of this decision. The U.S. has been saying unequivocally for 5 months now, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, we don't need your help. We don't want your help. Why the about face?
There's been a dance going on for quite some time between the U.S. and the U.N. The about face comes now because of two things. One, the need to get support of international countries is getting more acute every day on the ground. And two, the president needs support here in his own country. Congress has not been terribly happy with the direction of the policy, and bringing in international support is one of their top demands.
So we look at the other headlines from Washington, Bush's intention to go to Congress looking for another $60 or $70 billion, well, the return of Congress itself, the beginning of the presidential year. These are all factors that went into this decision?
They're all factors, but I think the dominant one is the situation on the ground. The U.S. is facing pressures, not just in the security area, but in getting the economy going, in getting a justice system up and running. And this is not something that the U.S. has all the right people in the country to do. There are a lot of good people working hard, but we're not up to the task with who we have in the country right now.
Robert, did the president wait too long?
The price of international involvement has been going up every day. Getting a broad coalition in early would have been much cheaper for the U.S., both in terms of blood and money. Now is a good time to do it. It would have been better before, but to wait longer, the price will only go up.
What's been lost? Explain that a little bit more for me. I can see how the U.S. can no longer look across the round table at the Security Council and say, we'd like you in, but if you don't want to come in, we don't need you. The U.S. is in a position of saying, we really have to have you in. And in that sense, they've lost negotiating room. But in what other way should we look at this as a costly delay?
The key issue here is the amount of decision-making authority the U.S. will have to share with all the other nations. And originally, a deal could have been struck that left the United States dominantly in charge of both the military side and the civilian side. Now that is in doubt. If the U.S. is to get significant international support, it will require a deal that shares some amount of decision-making authority.
I remember all the angst at the U.N. 6 months ago, February, March of this year. Is there more of that to come as the who's in charge debate starts at the U.N.?
There's definitely more of that to come. The negotiations underway at the U.N. will be rife with this kind of back corridor deal-making. It will mean decision-making authority within the Security Council and the UN. It will mean decision-making authority on the ground. None of the outlines of those deals are clear yet, but the fact is that there will have to be more decision-making authority shared than would have had to be shared 6 or 9 months ago if that deal had been struck then.
Let's hear how this is being viewed from other nations in the world. I want to go to Hossein Haqqani, who's joining us now on the line from Washington, D.C. Hossein is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, but I remember him as information minister with the Pakistani Prime Minister's Office. Hossein, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
I'm interested in your perspective here. I can imagine that President Musharraf, who is himself a military general, would probably like the idea of having Pakistani forces under a UN banner. But how well would it go down with the people in Pakistan?
Well, public opinion polls show that 86% of Pakistanis disapprove of getting involved or even supporting the United States in Iraq. General Musharraf has two reasons for wanting to send Pakistani troops there. The first part, of course, is he wants to oblige the U.S. and get whatever economic and military assistance benefits he can get from that. He is a military ruler, and public support is not that important to him. Then is the constant flow of foreign assistance. The second reason is he would like to see Pakistani troops interacting with American troops because Pakistan, under sanctions because of its nuclear program, has not had that quality of interaction. However, he has made it known that he would do so only under a UN banner. So if there is a UN resolution, which we see now is coming, then I think that Pakistan would be willing to send troops, but it will still be a very unpopular decision, and even the army may not necessarily like it.
Robert Orr was saying that the language, the style of the UN resolution that is eventually drafted will have a lot to do with that. Will people in Pakistan, both the government and the people on the street, be looking carefully at who's really in charge?
I think that it'll matter to the government because that'll give them some plausibility, something that they can tell the people. But I think public opinion is far too strong on this subject, and I don't think that this will sway. The language of the resolution will sway anything in terms of public opinion. But the U.S. does need troops on the ground, and in that sense, it will get them. Pakistan may give as many as 10,000 troops if a deal can be struck. However, the U.S. will have to pay off General Musharraf with more money and more guns in terms of assistance and aid.
Robert Orr, this sounds like it's going to cost the United States rather than save money if, in fact, as Hossein's describing it, more deals will have to be made to encourage more nations to take part.
There's a real trade-off here between the decision-making authority I was talking about and money. If the United States cedes decision-making authority, it can bring in the big countries that have lots of capacity and treasuries that can afford to pay to field that capacity. If the U.S. doesn't strike a deal that gives those countries the authority they need, then the U.S. will be bringing in countries in larger numbers that the U.S. Treasury needs to pay for. So there will be a trade-off there between money and decision-making authority.
All right, let's bring in another guest. Dr. Waheguru Palsido is joining us now. He directs the Regional Approaches to Peace Operations Project at the International Peace Academy in New York. He's joining us now on the line from Vancouver, British Columbia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Doctor, it was just a few months ago when the United States made a direct appeal to India saying, please, would you send troops to Iraq? And at that point, India said no. What's the situation today? How's that changed?
Well, let me talk a little bit about that background in the light of what Robert Orr has been saying, that the cost has in fact been going up. In terms of a background, India had very seriously considered the option when it was first offered, way back then. But subsequently, in fact, there had been fairly serious conversations between the Indians, the Americans, as well as the United Nations at that point of time. And a sector had already been earmarked for the Indian troops to come in as well, which is the northern sector of Iraq. The military was not just willing but also able to do this kind of an operation, but there was other sort of reluctance within the country itself. Now, clearly, that situation has changed very dramatically because of two or three events. First, of course, the bombing of the UN headquarters, the second, the bombing in Najaf of the historic mosque, and third is similar sort of bombings in Mumbai as well. And this is going to really put tremendous pause on any Indian enthusiasm for sort of involvement in Iraq.
I remember in the spring and early summer looking at the editorials in the Indian newspapers and seeing some of the strongest prose criticizing the United States for acting unilaterally. And I'm wondering if, as in Pakistan, public opinion against India joining this force will be a factor here.
Public opinion is certainly against the unilateral move on the part of the United States in Iraq. There's no doubt about that at all. But I think what's also now happened is, in the wake of the bombing of the UN headquarters, and in some ways the severe dent that is caused even to the UN credibility, I think there's now some doubt even in India of going in even under a UN flag, as it were. But by and large, you're right, public opinion is more or less opposed to this kind of an opposition, of this kind of an involvement, precisely because people tend to forget, but India is the second or the third largest Muslim country in the world.
So what's it going to take? Imagine the conversation at the United Nations. What's it going to take for the Indian diplomats there to turn around and say to Vajpayee, okay, I think we should go in?
Well, I think some of the Indian diplomats have already been telling Prime Minister Vajpayee that. It's Prime Minister Vajpayee who very strongly feels in not going into Iraq in this juncture. I mean, certainly a robust UN resolution making a very clear distinction that this is going to be a UN operation rather than a U.S.-led, U.N.-approved operation is going to be a very, very distinct element in that. But I think, in India at this juncture is also going to try and eke a sort of a significant price for itself within the U.N. system, and in terms of, decision-making, in terms of, forward policy, particularly regarding troops.
All right, Robert Orr?
I had a question for both of the other guests about whether or not Pakistan and India at this point would extract a commitment from the U.S. to serve only if it is a U.N. force, not just a U.S.-commanded, U.N.-blessed force. Does that make a difference to either of the governments at this point in time?
Hossein Haqqani, maybe from you first.
I think it does make a difference. I think that if it's a UN force and they are wearing blue helmets, I think it makes it easier for General Musharraf to sell that to his fellow generals, as well as to diminish some of the opposition. We must remember that religious scholars in Pakistan have already given fatwas that those soldiers who serve there and shoot at fellow Muslims will not be considered believers anymore, and things like that. And that does affect the morale of troops. So I think in that sense, yes, there is a difference, and I think that a UN force would definitely be preferable for General Musharraf.
Dr. Sidhu, we're very short on time here. Just a quick response from you.
Ideally, yes, but I think it would very much depend on how the Indians see the whole scenario unfolding after the attack on the UN headquarters in Iraq. They would have been much more enthusiastic before that, but after that, I think they'll have to really think about this a little bit more.
I want to thank both of you for being with us. Hossein Haqqani, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Dr. Wahid Gopal Sidhu, from the International Peace Academy in New York. Connection listeners, more on the UN options and the U.S. decision to turn to the UN. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Connection listeners, will the world gather under a UN banner for the good of Iraq? And if so, will there be a price for the United States to pay in delaying the request, which is now before the international body? I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest in studio this hour, Robert Orr, Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And Robert, I do want to pick up what both our previous guests were talking about, and that is the difference between UN and U.S. control, because I get a little bit confused. If you take a look at it in the minds or in the way it's being described by some, not much changes. The U.S. remains in control, except people swap the helmets or the berets for something blue. That's this is going to be difficult to work out, isn't it?
There is a big difference here, and I think at some level a number of the countries are still talking past each other. The U.S. is really only considering a multinational force headed by the U.S. and blessed by the U.N. A lot of the other countries that would like to be involved are talking about a U.N. force, and that is one commanded perhaps by an American general, but under the U.N. flag. There is a difference in terms of rules of engagement, in terms of needs of who to consult with before taking major decisions. So I don't think we're there yet in terms of what this force might look like.
It seems to me, though, that what the administration is saying is it's going to be U.S. command. There will be no U.N. rules of engagement. We want to make those military decisions.
I think that's a given that both the White House and I think in terms of where the Congress is on this, the U.S. Intends to stay in charge of this. And the question will be who will join the game if it doesn't look that different than it currently does.
So where's the space for the U.N. then? I mean, obviously, the United States would like to offload some of the difficult military police work and the civil engineering and the political work. But it's still all tied in many ways to the military occupation.
The U.S. and the current coalition need four things from the international community right now. They need troops. They need civilians with expertise in rebuilding. They need money. And they need political support. The U.S. can get all of those things if it is willing to strike a deal at the U.N. The U.N. resolution won't do all of those things. It's just a first step. In terms of the money, there's a donors conference coming down the tracks in late October, and right now one would not expect more than a very modest set of contributions coming in. If a deal can be struck here, and if a number of countries have troops on the way, then it's much more likely that those same countries and others will make larger financial contributions as well. But let's not forget the civilian aspect here. The real expertise to rebuild Iraq is going to come from Iraqis and from international experts that will work alongside them, civilian experts. And right now, we just don't have that many civilians in country, and we need to change that equation fairly dramatically.
One of the other nations that has been named as possibly sending troops is Turkey. We're joined on the line now by Bulent Alireza. He's senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and director of the Turkey Project there. He's been with us on The Connection before. Bulent, welcome back.
Thanks.
Tell me what the conversation is in Ankara over this right now. Would the Turkish military willingly join up with American soldiers who are currently in Iraq?
Well, if you look at what the chief of staff has been saying, the Turkish army seems disposed to send troops, and the figures that have been discussed range from 3,000 to 10,000 and maybe more. Clearly, the Turkish military perceives the problem very much in the context of the U.S.-Turkish bilateral relationship, which was damaged by the Turkish reluctance to allow U.S. troops to attack Iraq from the north in March. And this is one way to actually get over that. Beyond that, they would very much like to contribute to ending the instability in Iraq, which they ultimately fear would lead to the emergence of a Kurdish state with all sorts of dangers for Turkey's own Kurdish population.
But imagine for a minute a Turkish soldier serving with a UN blue beret on under direct U.S. military command. The Iraqis aren't stupid on this. They're going to look at the Turkish soldier and say, well, you're just a stooge of Uncle Sam. You're just doing the bidding of Washington. We won't respect you any more than we won't respect the U.S. soldiers.
Well, there have been lots of stories in the Turkish press ever since the question of sending Turkish troops was broached back in July. Of Iraqis saying precisely that in the event that Turkish soldiers were sent to Iraq, that they would be attacked in exactly the same way as the U.S. soldiers. And the big question for the government, which let us remember is of Islamist origin, is do we want to send our troops to actually kill fellow Muslims and to actually die in Iraq? And one official told me on my most recent visit to Turkey that it would be very difficult for the government to explain exactly why it is that soldiers died beyond Turkey's borders.
This is an absolutely crucial point that if the opposition in Iraq has shown anything, it's that they have a strategy and it's to go after soft targets, the UN, Shiite clerics, And I would expect that to continue. If international soldiers come in, if international civilians come in, one good way to split the coalition is to go after those soft targets. So ironically, this will put increasing security demands on U.S. soldiers because they'll have more targets to help protect.
This goes back to what Dr. Wahiguru was saying about the bombing of the UN headquarters and wondering, you know, whether or not one's own soldiers would be any safer than American soldiers who have been shot at for the past 5 months. Bulent Alireza, tell me how much public opinion is going to come to bear in this decision. Will this be, is this a tough one for Turkish leaders?
A very tough one. It's, in fact, tougher than the decision on March 1st when the General Assembly, Turkish National Assembly, said no to U.S. troops coming through Turkey to join the war. Because in this case, Turkey would not be acting as a transit country for U.S. forces, but would actually be sending forces into harm's way. And public opinion, just as before the March 1st vote, is opposed to what the government's inclined to do. The difference this time is that the military seems determined to use this as leverage to improve the relationship with the U.S., as I said. But it's going to be a very tough one for the government. And although the government was talking about bringing the National Assembly back for an extraordinary session in September, it looks more and more likely that the decision will be left after the 1st of October when the National Assembly comes back. They're very much aware of the fact that almost two-thirds of the Turkish public do not want Turkish troops to go there.
Do you think this is a decision which will be made largely based on Turkish interests? The issue of how much control the Kurds in the north have, the question of the safety of Turkish soldiers there, rather than the grander picture of what's best for Iraq, how to resolve the situation that the U.S. has got itself into?
Well, clearly, Turkey would have preferred that the war not take place. The government made the case to the U.S. before March 1st, certainly, that the war should not happen beyond just beyond Turkey's borders. But now that it's taken place, I think the decision is being taken on the basis of Turkish national interests and primarily the Turkish interest in restoring the relationship with the United States. Now, at the same time, clearly, the government and the military are calculating the costs, primarily the costs in terms of lives lost, and Turkey's relations with the wider Arab world. You know, how will it be perceived if Turkey sends troops to actually fight alongside U.S. forces and perceived as solidifying the forces of occupation over there? It's a very tough decision for the government, and the Kurdish factor, as you said, comes into it. Turkey is very worried about the strengthening of the Kurdish position in Iraq. The U.S.-Kurdish alliance in northern Iraq, which is partly a product of Turkey's unwillingness to allow U.S. forces to come through Turkey. The fact that Iraq now has Hoshi Akzabari, a Kurd, as foreign minister is, I think, important symbolically. At the same time, they're worried about 3,000 to 4,000 Turkish Kurds in a terrorist organization called Kadek, which have been fighting Turkish forces. They want the United States to actually move on these forces as part of a grand bargaining process, which is just started with the U.S., with the arrival of the U.S. commander in Europe, Jim Jones, yesterday, and a delegation from CENTCOM that arrived in Ankara today. So I think what we're going to get is a prolonged process of negotiation and bargaining between Ankara and Washington.
Bulent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Bulent Alireza is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, director of the Turkey Project there. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to call us in just a minute. Before we do that, Robert, what's come up in comments from the people who are looking at the situation in Pakistan and India and Turkey is the difficulty that the soldiers themselves will face there if they are Arab or if they are Muslim, and when how easy it will be for them to operate in Iraq. Is this going to be a key part of the UN deliberation, not just sending in a sort of mixed salad of soldiers from all over the world, but specifically choosing where they come from?
This is always a key part of the equation. One needs countries that are not so interested in the country that their soldiers have multiple agendas going on. At the same time, they clearly need to have enough of an interest in the country to be willing to send their soldiers there and shed blood. But I think what it will take is a grand negotiation at the UN to kind of construct the right multilateral force, but it will also take a series of relatively expensive bilateral deals between the U.S. and each of the major troop contributors.
1-800-423-TALK to join us. Let's take our first call from Madison, Wisconsin. Habu's joining us. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning to everybody.
Thanks for calling.
Before I say what I'm going to say, let me just say I think getting rid of the brutal Saddam Hussein was the right thing for the Iraqi people. But having said that, and also I'm quite sympathetic to the men and women who are slogging it out in the desert there. Having said that, let me say this. It seems like we're going around, we're saying everything but the right thing.
The United States here?
About the United States and United Nations, this negotiation, this, that, the other. You know, it really comes down to this. The Iraqi people, and I'm not speaking for the Iraqi people, but from what I can discern, they are going to resist any country. It doesn't matter whether it's from a Muslim country, from an Indian country, from a Western country. They are going to resist any UN representatives that are seen to be doing the bidding of the United States, and they will kill them, very simply put. And this whole thing about...
Even if they are persuaded that the soldiers from other countries are there for reasons that are not attached to the accusations of occupation or the expectations that the U.S. wants, you know, all the baggage that the Iraqis have in their view of the American occupation. You think it's too late now?
To answer your question, I think we are in a very sticky situation, and I'm not trying to be overdramatic. If we put more troops in, be it American or anybody, there are going to be more targets, and this is kind of a Vietnam-style resistance. And if we leave, there is going to be a kind of implosion, and this with shock waves emanating to Saudi Arabia and $200 a price of oil per barrel. But this is what I want to. This is the central point I want to make. I think it is come time for the United States to admit. It has to admit that it erred, and also, more importantly, relinquish any claims it has on Iraqi oil and, you know, the privatization of that society. That has to be done by the Iraqi people. And only then, when the Iraqis perceive that whoever is coming in to stabilize but not to kind of conquer and impose these kinds of draconian measures, certainly by their measures, by their standards.
Let me turn this to Robert, because I mean, one of the hallmarks of this particular administration is not giving a lot of quarter on issues like that. The president's not going to wear a hair shirt. He's not going to say, we made a mistake, so come and help us out.
Absolutely not. That is not this president's style. And I think what is needed more than anything in Iraq is security. And that is the goal of this internationalization. Habu is absolutely correct that just because they're international soldiers won't mean that Iraqis don't attack them. But what it would do is increase the coverage of security in the country, which is necessary to get life back into normal channels, to allow people to go to work, to go about their daily life. That's the goal, not just to reduce attacks on coalition forces. If anyone's going into this thinking that international soldiers will get attacked less than Americans, they'll have a terrible awakening.
And what about the Western nations, countries like Germany, Canada, France, which were asked, chose not to take part in the original force? Are the politicians or the people in those countries going to be looking for at least some kind of oblique apology or request for help? You know what I'm talking about.
Certainly the Western nations will be looking for more of that recognition that the U.S. has made mistakes. It would make it easier for them to push this with their publics, because their publics certainly think the U.S. has made mistakes.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Brookline, Massachusetts, and Zach's joining us. Hi, Zach.
Hi. How are you?
Calling. I'm fine.
I would disagree with what your speaker was just saying. I think that we're not going to get anybody to help us out, especially from the European side, until we apologize, period.
That's exactly what Robert was just saying, that the European side will be looking for at least some diplomatic gesture of apology. We may redefine that in a month or so when we understand how it's going to work. But
Because I think that until we bring in a force in Iraq that is neutral, was not involved in the initial conflict, the Iraqi people will not start, you know, taking the blame themselves when things go wrong and take matters into their own hands. I think that at the moment, it's just going in the wrong direction. You know, we might need more troops, we might not, but I think I just heard that there are some documents being released saying that our army's being stretched to the limits at the moment. You know, this might require a draft even. If, you know, I'm 17, I'm going to be 18 soon. And I think that, you know, this is a scary moment because I think we are in a situation where the country is fighting a war that, you know, maybe was not justified in the beginning. And, you know, unless we start bringing in help from outside, we're going to have the whole burden on our own hands. And, you know, I
want to, Zach, if I can, pick up your reference to the report. It was the Congressional Budget Office's review of the expenses here, which seems in many ways, Robert, to have precipitated where we are right now. And so the CBO looks at the numbers and says, we can't afford to keep the soldiers there. And I was reading that and thinking to myself, well, what's the Joint Chief of Staff? You know, what have those people been looking at, and why haven't they been making the case? Now, I see, in fact, that they might have been making the case all along that what we're seeing now, or what's illuminated by this, is a real power struggle at the White House between the military people at the Pentagon and the civilian people at the Pentagon.
There's no question that there was some optimism, maybe unchecked optimism before the war, that this would be a clean decapitation of Iraqi forces. It would require U.S. troops only for a short period. We were supposed to be down to 40,000 by this point in time, by the, quote, end of the summer. That clearly, that planning, if you want to call it that, has not proven very accurate. So now the question is, going forward, can we plan and do this in an international context?
Connection listeners, we'll pick that up when we come back after the break. Zach, thanks very much for joining us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What is the price now, or what will the price be of the U.S. turning to the U.N. for assistance in not only rebuilding but maintaining security in Iraq? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Quite a remarkable about-face this week as the White House says it's time to turn to the UN for assistance in its involvement in Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Ibrahim Musa is listening to the program today. He's a professor of religion at Duke University, has been a guest on the program, and has called in with his perspective. Ibrahim, nice to have you on the program again.
Nice to talk to you again, Dick. The only contribution I want to make is I think the several of your speakers have made the point that security is a crucial aspect. And I'm wondering whether the only people that could really offer lasting and enduring security would not be the Iraqis themselves. And that the way forward would be to make sure that sovereignty passes into the hands of Iraqis as soon as possible. I think that, I don't know if anybody had raised this question, but Paul Bremer's dissolution of the Iraqi army was one colossal mistake. And I think that if in any democracy such an irresponsible decision requires a resignation, or whoever instructed him to do so, requires a need to resign the position, because I think that's a very highly irresponsible thing to do and has led and contributed to the mess that we have in Iraq right now.
Ibrahim, I'm going to thank you for your call. Your line's a little bit dodgy, so I'm going to let you go. But I want to take the point that you're making with Robert Orr, who's in the studio with me, and push it ahead a little bit, Robert, because this has been an extremely difficult area for the American civilians in Iraq, trying to decide how much control they can give to the Iraqi Governing Council. If they're are to be blue helmets on the street, if there is UN involvement in trying to figure out politically what comes next for Iraq, can that move any faster?
Well, the key here is that this is not an either-or proposition. It's not that you need either Iraqis or international support. You actually need both. It will take serious time to build up an Iraqi police force, an Iraqi army. And what you need are a sufficient number of international policemen, soldiers that are willing to go on joint patrols for the next 2 years with those new forces to get them up to speed to be able to handle the very significant security challenges in Iraq.
But is there, as Ibrahim suggests, a major setback to that by the disbanding of the army? Is it going to take still a long time to get Iraqi security officers to sit at least on one side of the jeep seat?
The decision to disband the Iraqi army was the biggest mistake we've made in Iraq. It is something that we're still trying to recover from. When you take 400,000 people who are trained in arms, still have arms, and turn them loose, you guarantee yourself a difficult security situation for quite some time to come. We did reverse that partially and started paying stipends to a lot of those former Iraqi military, but they aren't actually being re-engaged to do anything. They go and pick up a check, and then they have their day free to do whatever they would have done anyway. So what we need is a significant program of reintegration, get some of them back into a new army, get some of them into a police force, and get some of them retrained to do other meaningful tasks in the economy.
Robert, is there expertise at the UN to speed that process, perhaps expertise that doesn't exist with the U.S. military at present?
The UN has a mixed record on things like civilian policing in countries. We've heard horror stories from places like Bosnia. But at the same time, the UN has significant experience in policing, and I think we've learned a lot from a tough decade through the 90s. The UN and its member nations do have a number of police available that the U.S. does not. We could try to tap every available police officer in America, and we couldn't put enough on the street in Iraq to really build a new force.
1-800-423-8255 to join us to Providence, Rhode Island now, and Marie's on the line. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I tuned in late, like I explained. I want to know, has anyone identified who is doing the killing of the American soldiers or the people that are over there trying to help the Iraqis?
You mean, and will that change if there's a U.N. force
there? Yeah, right
there?
Now our American troops are nothing more than sacrificial lambs. They're being like sitting ducks. And if you put somebody else over there, and you're going to have the same situation unless you have some intelligence that tells you who is doing this.
You know, this is a part of the story, Robert, that I think is often missed. The Iraqi people, particularly the people in Baghdad, are extremely well-educated, extremely eager to tune in their shortwave radios to the BBC World Service. They're going to know what the details of the UN resolution are. They're going to know precisely how much control the U.S. has given away to the UN. Will that knowledge make a difference when we look at the people who are taking pot shots at soldiers and building these bombs?
Marie's question is a great one, because it's a varied group of individuals who are attacking U.S. and coalition personnel. You do have former regime members, loyalists to Saddam. They're clearly in the mix. There are international elements coming into the country from various places that are increasingly in the mix. You have generalized crime on the street that affect mostly the Iraqis, and then you do have crime syndicates that are making large amounts of money on the chaos in parts of the country. So you really need to break down who is committing which crimes if you're going to try to solve the general insecurity problem.
Okay, Marie, I hope that helps you there. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Natick, Massachusetts, and Sam's joining us. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam. This is Sam. Thank you for letting me in. I'll be very brief. Now, my question is this. Obviously, there has been a shift in foreign policy here. And this U-turn perhaps says a lot about our credibility. How do we, it has shown the limitations of our guided missiles and misguided priorities. What does this say to our, status as the only superpower in the world today? We said no, and then we said yes.
I wonder, Sam, if it works in reverse, though, where the United States is able to say at the United Nations, you know what, this is us saying we may have made a mistake and now we need the help of the UN.
Well, okay, if they have to, the only way they can say, you know, admit that error now is either Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State to go, resign, get someone else in. That will make it much easier.
Okay, Robert Orr, I was thinking about that earlier today when reading in one of the morning papers that this is not a win for Powell but a significant loss for Rumsfeld, and wondering whether or not, in fact, heads might roll here.
Well, listening to Sam talk about a U-turn, I think of this maybe more as an L right now. We're starting to turn from where we've been going, but it's not clear yet if we're going to make that 180-degree turn and do something totally different. I think that is still open for negotiation internationally and open for negotiation within the administration. I think they are still debating within about just how much decision-making authority can and should be ceded to international partners in this.
So when the U.S. goes to the Security Council with a resolution and says this is what we'd like, and if the other nations on the Security Council start unrolling these great long lists of demands, you think it's possible that this administration will say, you know, we tried. We went to the U.N., we looked for help, but the price was just too high.
It's absolutely possible that it could play out that way. There's nothing here that a clean resolution is foreordained.
Sam, what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm afraid it's not going to work. You know, this, again, goes back to psychosocial and behavioral science of ethnicity. It can't, before we went to war, I thought about it. I clenched. I cannot see our young men and women marching in the street of the heart of Muslim country, you know, in Baghdad. It just won't work. This is, you know, something drastic, you know, has to happen here to salvage and halt the spinning.
Okay, but Sam, let me pick it up with your own suggestion. If someone like Donald Rumsfeld were to step aside saying, my advice has been bad advice and the UN and the U.S. need to move forward, wouldn't that be enough for the other nations at the United Nations to say, fair enough?
Yes. Let me tell you, that will, in fact...
I'm not counseling him, by the way.
No,
imagining.
That will be the most graceful way of saying, Germany, France, we are sorry. African countries, we are sorry. We made a mistake. You know, we shouldn't have done it, but we have done it. Now is not the time to continue on that path. Let's reconcile right now. So long as Rumsfeld is there, our Secretary of State, you know, by the way, I'm black, Secretary of State, being in the UN, telling the world something that turns out to be a lie. And then now we are going back and say, come back. They can't buy it.
I got bad news for you, Sam. He's not the first person to bend the truth at the United Nations. And this is, I don't know, Robert, give me again your insight on working in that institution. How much of what's going to happen next, say, over the next 6 weeks, is going to be done in public, and how much of it is going to be done in back rooms, out of sight and the sound of the microphones?
This will look a lot like an iceberg. You will see the tip of it, but the vast majority of what goes on will happen behind the scenes. There may be leaks into press by various countries that want to shape it in a certain way, but this will be done mostly between capitals. It will be done in the back corridors of the UN, and only when there's a deal about to be struck will you start to see it in public circles.
And one of the things we haven't talked about today is what influence Britain's decisions may have in this. Britain, if I'm not mistaken, is holding the chair of the Security Council at present. We also got news today that the Defense Secretary in Britain wants to do a review of the number of troops who are involved over there. So is there perhaps some kind of lockstep happening here with Washington and folks at Downing Street coordinating what comes next?
UK has been pressing for a while for a development along these lines. Prime Minister Blair is under significant pressure within his own country, and the best way for him to relieve that pressure is to convince the U.S. and prove that his partnership with George Bush can be used to alter the course of U.S. policy. If he were to gain that, it would solidify his government and his standing. So clearly,
We should pay attention to what comes next from Blair on this particular issue.
Absolutely.
The news also this week that the American military has given a certain amount of control over a certain portion of Iraq, which I believe includes Najaf, to Polish soldiers. Is this a bit of a testing ground? Would the people in Iraq hope that this be seen as what might be in the weeks or months ahead?
This is a very important test, both from the Iraqi perspective, I think, and for the Americans and the international community. The Marines, which had been largely in control of the sector that the Poles are now running, had done a phenomenal job there. I visited a number of them in some very difficult circumstances, and they were doing a really great job. The Poles are taking over at a very sensitive time. The holy cities of Najaf and Karbala, it's a potential hotbed. And if things start going wrong in the Shiite parts of the country, then the entire occupation is put into question.
But the Polish soldiers are still operating under U.S. command here.
Under U.S. command, but the sector will be run by a Polish general. And that will be a testing ground to see if both the command structure works and also if the Iraqis respond to Poles any differently than to Americans, if they try to test them, if they try to kill a few Poles to see if that will force them out.
And I was wondering today what it's going to take for Iraqis, ordinary Iraqis, to see a change, and thinking that it might just be the answer to this question. If Iraqis believe that what happens at the UN is in the best interest of Iraq rather than in the best interest of George Bush in an election year, do you think they'd be more inclined to give space to an international force on their streets, on their highways?
Iraqis are amazingly flexible on these issues. In the same conversation, many Iraqis will start out saying, you need to go home, you know, thank you for liberating us, now go home, and then within a minute or two be back to, well, we need to work together on this. We need to help shape the Iraqi decision-making process right now. There is no set view within the Iraqi populace right now. It's a very diverse group of opinions, and it still can be shaped.
Robert, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Robert Orr, Executive Director for Research at Harvard's Belfer Center. Earlier in the program, we talked with Bulent Alireza, Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Dr. Wahiguro Palsidu is Senior Associate at the International Peace Academy, and Hussein Haqqani, Visiting Scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Connection listeners will be back on this subject not long from now, so we get a chance to continue the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.